Obviously, I should have sent in a shorter bio. Thanks very much. It's a pleasure to have a chance to talk about this. This talk grows out of something that has bothered me for several decades, actually. And I have no financial benefits from it, I'm afraid. But it's kind of a paradox. When we do studies of variables that are misclassified and we find significant results, we often say, well, the true effects or the true odds ratio must actually be even larger than the one that we found because our results are misclassified. And we know that that random misclassification biases toward the null. But if you follow that line of thinking and you say, well, supposing I had two studies, one of which has misclassified variables, the other has really well-measured variables, and I had the same odds ratio, that line of thinking leads you to say, well, the one that had the misclassified variables actually is the more important because the underlying odds ratio must have been even stronger to get the one that I'm looking at. Well, if you pursue that line of thinking very far, you can see that it's kind of anti-scientific. It's basically saying something that's measured badly produces a result that's more important than something that's measured well. So this talk really grew out of trying to figure out how you could kind of make sense out of that. So I'm going to start by just giving you some data I made up about a case control study. I tried to set it up so that it would have 90% power to detect an odds ratio of 2, and the exposure frequency in the control group was about 41%. And then when you do the sample size calculations, it turned out you need about 200 cases and 200 controls. So then if you put that in a 2x2 table, assuming that the hypothesis is true, that there's no sampling error, that there's no misclassification, you get data that look like this, where you have 117 exposed cases, and 83 not exposed, and the reverse in the controls. And that works out to an odds ratio of 2, and the power I have with that sample size of 200 cases and 200 controls works out to 2.0, as I'm showing on the upper left-hand part of the table there. And you just have to take my word for it that those calculations are correct. All right, now I'm going to introduce some misclassification into this. And if we misclassified 20% of the cases of the exposed into the not exposed, and 20% of the not exposed up into the exposed, as I've shown on the left hand under the cases, so 20% of the 117 that we had in the prior slide, in which I'm showing in small typeface, would be about 23.3, so you subtract that, but then you add 16.7, which would have been 20% of the 83 that were originally in the not exposed cases, and that brings you to 110. And similarly for 90 and the same in the controls, although I don't show the calculations there. So when you do that, of course, it does bias your odds ratio toward the null. They're now 1.5. And because the odds ratio is that you're trying to detect is lower, the power with that same sample size also falls. It's now down to 51%. And if you were to misclassify 35% of the exposed as not exposed and 35% of the not exposed as exposed, then the odds ratio falls to 1.22, and the power to detect that with the same sample size falls to 17%. So my first inference is that substantial misclassification leads to substantial loss of power that is generally not considered in planning observational studies. And for those of you who've done any work in clinical trials, you'll know that the clinical trials people actually do plan their studies for what we call crossovers, which is a form of exposure misclassification. So in clinical trials, people have thought about this and have incorporated it into their sample size calculations. But for the most part, in our observational studies, we have just ignored it. We just say, well, we take it as we measure it, and we just look at the frequency of exposure as it's measured and calculate our sample size with our alpha and beta and so forth. So another piece of this is, you know, I've taught for many years that, until this year actually, that, you know, once you have your results from a study and you have the odds ratio estimate and the confidence limits, that then I really don't worry, or I haven't worried in the past, about what the power of the study was. Because, you know, I have a significant result, I have confidence limits around it. What did I care whether the study was well-powered or not? But it turns out, actually, when you think about it, that that's not actually sensible. Because if the power of the study is really low, then the chance that you really have found what you think you found goes down. And in the extreme example, where if you actually had a completely random variable and you found a significant result, you'd have to conclude that's an alpha error, right? A random variable couldn't really have shown you anything. So when you have a significant result, you nevertheless have to think a little bit about power. All right, now I want to go, I'm going to set this up a little like the 2x2 tables that we often use when we do sensitivity and specificity. So I'm just showing you a sensitivity specificity format to prepare you for what I'm going to do next. So in sensitivity and specificity, you have people who truly have the disease, which in this example are A plus C down at the bottom of the middle column, or the slightly left-hand column. And then you have people who really do not have the disease, which is B plus D. And the prevalence of the disease here, right, is going to be A plus C over the total, which is going to be A plus C plus B plus D. And the test result, and this is a little screw, where it says reject the null, really should be the test, that should be test positive, which would reject the null, I guess. So that your sensitivity then would be A over A plus C, and your specificity would be D over B plus D, right? And your prevalence, as I said, was A plus C over B plus D, but the odds of having the disease, where you drop the numerator out of the denominator, would be A plus C over B plus D before you did the test, and after you do the test, it would be just A over B. So the case I'm going to make is that a research study can be viewed as analogous to a diagnostic test, where the study tests whether a particular hypothesis is true. And the prior odds or probability that the hypothesis is true, of course, in this case is unknown, because we don't have anything quite as simple as the prevalence of the disease to give us our prior odds. But the evidence added by the study can be assessed by estimating how much the odds increase when a significant result is found. And for those of you who are into specificity and sensitivity and those things, it sort of corresponds to the likelihood ratio of the test. And this is actually set up in Hennekin's elementary book. He has a table that looks very much like this. So in this case, we have a hypothesis that's true, and a hypothesis is false instead of true disease and not having disease. And when you do your study, if it rejects the null hypothesis, the P times 1 minus beta is really the power of the test to detect it times the prior probability that the thing is true. Probability of rejecting the null when the hypothesis is false would be your alpha level, so that if H1 is false, you get a significant result, despite the fact that the null hypothesis is actually true in this case, and that would be the alpha level. So if you multiply that alpha probability times the flip side of times 1 minus the prior probability, that gives you the probability of, or that is one of the things you're going to measure. And then the posterior odds becomes P times 1 minus beta divided by alpha times 1 minus P. And when you resort that, you get 1 minus beta over alpha times P over 1 minus P. So whatever the prior odds of the hypothesis being true is, the value of your study, the additional information it gives you about how true that is all captured by 1 minus beta over alpha, which is a piece of the posterior odds. And when you stop to think about it, you know, we normally expect our power, we usually say a minimal power is 80%, 0.8. We usually demand an alpha level of 0.05. So we're really expecting, with those minimal requirements for our studies, to have a likelihood ratio of 16. So that the posterior odds when you have a single positive study is 16 times whatever the prior odds are. So if your prior odds, you have a very unlikely prior hypothesis, if it only had a 1% chance of being true, and you found a significant result with 80% power, you're only pushing that up to like about a 16% chance that it's true with a single study. So thinking about what the power is turns out to be important. So my second inference is that it's basically what I just said. And obviously, if your power falls below 80%, in order to maintain that ratio, which we inherently kind of accept of 16, you would need to have a lower alpha in order to do that. Thus, a nominal significance level of 0.05 with known misclassification and reduced power is actually not appropriate, and we need to get a smaller alpha in that case. And in some sense, that sort of resolves my paradox, because although it is true that if you have a misclassified variable and you get a significant result, the true result may have a higher odds ratio than the one you measured. At the same time, it's reducing the chance that your basic finding is actually true, unless you make an adjustment for that. So a substantial misclassification calls for a more stringent level of significance, and it's a little analogous to multiple significance testing in that sense. And this just shows you that as your power falls, how much you have to adjust your alpha level adjust for that. So the other thing to think about is that as your power falls, you need to adjust your sample size to detect these very small odds ratios. In the 20% misclassification example that I showed you, the proportional increase in sample size is 2.7-fold to adjust for that. And if you go to 35% misclassification, your sample size would have to be 18-fold. So in our observational studies, as we get into substantial misclassification, we really are deluding ourselves, thinking we can do those studies with the nominal sample size calculations that we actually use. So in conclusion, claims for the importance of significant results reported in the face of misclassified exposure need to be qualified with recognition that the posterior odds for the hypothesis may be reduced. And investigators should include estimates of misclassification in planning sample sizes for observational studies, much as is actually done now with clinical trials. That's my talk.